So welcome to week four once again. And week one, we talked about Samson as a unique savior for the Jews. He fights solo. He fights on Philistine territory. He spares the Jews from getting involved in the fight. That's the positive way to spin it. Now, I am not audible, I'm told. Hang on one second. We're going to solve that one also.
Okay.
Audible now, right? You hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. We said in week one that Samson fights on Philistine territory on his own. The positive spin on that is that he is sparing the Jews from having to fight the Philistines. They're not ready for it. The Jews make him their leader for 20 years. Don Isaac Abarbanel explained that this is their reaction to the way that he is battling the Plishtim, the Philistines. And then, starting in week two, we looked at Samson as a Nazarite. And specifically for him, he doesn't have all the rules of the Nazarite, as the Talmud explained, as we saw in Maimonides as well, to become impure from contact with the dead. However, he is not allowed to drink wine, have grape products, and of course he's not allowed to cut his hair. And we said that if being a Nazarite is about restraint, it's a reaction to perhaps witnessing what happens when people drink too much. So he's trying to restrain himself. That doesn't really seem to work with Samson. He isn't living that kind of restrained life. However, we also saw that a Nazarite might be a social role model, somebody who is meant to guide people to have a closer relationship with God. And in the language of the text of the Torah, to be somebody who is a more holy person, even as he struggles with his own flaws. And that's something that shows up in Samson's life and is really going to show up today. This is really, this is my favorite part. And favorite is an odd word, perhaps, in a sense, because this is a painful chapter that we're going to read today, but nonetheless, you'll see what I mean, I think. We're talking about betrayal and faith in the story of Samson, and I polled people towards the end last time as to whether you see Samson as a model of faith in God, betrayal of God, both, neither, and I think a lot of people said both. I think most people said that they see in him a model of betrayal and a model of faith. And we talked about at the very end how Samson's life involves betrayal of other people by him, as well as, and really more, betrayal of Samson by others. And if you look at the top of the source sheet, and for those who didn't get it, I'm going to put it in the chat. I'll put the link in the chat again. I put it in sources 1 and 2. We saw Samson betraying others by marrying Philistines, he's betraying the Jews, the haircut, of course, giving away his secret when God has said that he's not supposed to cut his hair. On the other hand, Samson is betrayed by others throughout his story, starting with the people at his first wedding. The first and perhaps only, he doesn't marry the other Philistine women, but his wife gives away the riddle, then his wife is given away to others, and then the Philistines attack his wife and his in-laws, and the tribe of Judah hands him over to the Philistines, and the woman who it appears turns him over in Aza, and of course Delilah with the haircut, right? We saw apparent betrayal after apparent betrayal. Everyone is still able to hear me all right? It's harder. I don't have the same feedback as I have because of this weird system with the phone. So,
sounds good.
Okay, thank
yes,
you.
Good.
So, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about one particular story of betrayal, which is so troubling and frankly resonates for us even today. And that is the story from chapter 15. When the tribe of Judah turns Samson over to the Philistines. Because I think all of us, when we read that, were kind of shocked. Like, the Philistines come to the tribe of Judah and say, turn over Samson. And they come to Samson and say, let's do it. And Samson, of course, says to them, sure. As long as you're not going to attack me, I'm good for that. You know what? I'm going to see if my computer can sustain running the poll, because I want to know what you think here. So if my computer can do it, I'm going to, here we go. I'm going to launch a poll which asks you your opinion here about the tribe of Judah turning over Samson. So let's see if the poll will be able to launch. No, it's not able to, it's not able to launch. So I'm skipping the poll. Sorry. It would have been fun. But the question of whether the tribe of Judah is wrong for doing this is one that plays out today as well, right? What will be the modern analogy for the question of turning over Samson? What would be the analogous case in our day?
Trying to retrieve soldiers against Arab prisoners.
Right, right. Releasing terrorists in order to redeem either our soldiers who are being held hostage, or civilians who are being held hostage, or sometimes the bodies of Israelis that are being held. And the question of what do you do when it's a matter of endangering one party in order to save another party. So the tribe of Judah decides that they need to hand over Samson, endangering him for their sake. Can you give me a justification for what they did?
Hmm.
Yes, Nuit.
At that time, I believe each tribe was on its own type of thing. They were not united as one.
Right.
So they were looking after their own safety.
They're looking after their own safety. But can you give me a justification that makes that okay? Meaning usually when we say look after your own welfare and harm somebody else, that's not justified. Can you give me a justification?
Sacrificing one for many?
Ah, so Pearl says, and I see Jeanette's hand, I don't know if you were going the same way, but one approach would be you save the majority. There are far more people in the tribe of Judah than the one man, Samson, and so therefore we should save the majority. Moish, you were going to say? Moish?
Oh, sorry, I didn't hear you. Well, they've got 500 years of history on their back. They're just repeating what they did to Yosef for whatever reason they had.
So that's an interesting idea.
They only sold him. It's a difference.
Right. It's an interesting idea. The only difference, of course, being that Samson wasn't from Joseph, but he hadn't done anything directly to harm them, whereas Joseph can be seen as a threat directly to his brothers. Nonetheless, I hear your point that in general this isn't the only time in Tanakh, and it isn't the only time in our history that this takes place. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 3. You know, Jeanette wrote in the chat, it's not halachically correct, but it's an understandable moral justification. It actually may well be halachically correct to turn over the many. Marlene writes a note in the chat that the tribe of Judah is not in danger. That's actually a great debate among commentators in this story. Because when the Philistines come to you and say, hand over Samson, generally speaking, if your answer is no, you are in danger. You don't get to say no to the Philistines. And that's why many commentators assume that this was an act, in fact, of self-preservation. But take a look at source number 3. I saw a couple of other hands, but I want to jump into the text itself, because whereas there is time for us to do a week 4, there isn't time for us to do a week 5. So if you take a look at number 3, the Jerusalem Talmud brings you the following, and just to explain one bit of information that's in it, it's going to mention a man named Sheva, son of Bichri, Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri ran a revolt against King David. That's what you need to know about him in order to understand this story, is that he created a revolt against King David, and ultimately the people in the city where he took shelter killed him in order to save the city from the army that was attacking them. So if you take a look at source number 3, and everybody just froze, can you see me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, this is One of those things that happens from time to time. Okay, we deal with it. So the Jerusalem Talmud says the following in source number 3. We have learned, if groups of people were traveling on the road, and they encountered non-Jews who said, give us one of yours, and we will kill him, or we will kill all of you. Okay, so you have a caravan of people. They're traveling on the road. They get attacked by bandits. And the bandits say, either we're going to kill all of you, or give us one. But they don't name who should be turned over. Then even if all of them will be killed, they may not surrender a single life of Israel. You're not allowed to turn somebody over. And the reason for that, it's relatively straightforward, is because then you're choosing who is going to get turned over. Right? In other words, your options are turn over this person and this person gets hurt and everybody else is saved, or turn over the next person and the next person gets hurt and everybody else is saved. By choosing someone, you are condemning that person to death. We're assuming that that's the case. The bandits are going to kill them. So you are choosing who is going to die. So don't do that. But if the attackers designated one, they said, this is the one I want, as happened with Sheva ben Bichri, who rebelled against the throne, they surrender him and they are not killed. And the logic here is relatively straightforward, because this person's dead either way. Either you turn him over and he's dead, or you don't turn him over and everybody, including him, is dead. So this person is a dead man anyway. That would be a simple way to frame the story. There's another way to frame it, but that's a simple way to frame the story. But then you have a debate among two sages. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, only if the victim is liable for death like Sheva ben Bichri. He says, you want to know why Sheva was different? It isn't just that the army said, turn this man over. It's that he was a criminal. He was a rebel against the throne. So therefore, what they were doing was, in some sense, justified. So that's why you turn him over. But otherwise, you can't turn over anybody, even if the other side demands that you turn him over. Rabbi Yochanan disagreed, and he said, no, it doesn't matter. We save the majority, and you turn this fellow over. You follow? Everyone clear? You understand what we're saying here? They're dealing with our case. They know, no one's mentioning Samson, but it applies to our case and the decision to turn him over when the Philistines have demanded him. So you could look at this practically and say, you're doing this in order to save everybody else. That's one way that you can look at it. You can look at it in other ways. You could say, effectively, that this is, not an act of harming this person, it's an act of saving everybody else, right? The concept of double effect. I am looking at the effect of saving lives. I'm not looking at the effect of killing him. What I'm doing is life-saving. But fundamentally, and this is the important point to come away with, when there is a debate in the Talmud between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, we follow Rabbi Yochanan. That's a general principle. So Rabbi Yochanan is the one who says, you turn him over. We're going to put the welfare of the majority before the welfare of the individual. That seems to be the statement. Are we clear? Okay. This will not necessarily apply in the case of ransoming terrorists that kind of a case. The reason why is because there may be value for the community in saving the individual soldier. Meaning, what happens today where you turn over 1,000 terrorists in order to save one soldier is in part because the soldiers in the IDF have to know that you have their back, that the nation is going to take care of them. And that changes the dynamic somewhat in this calculation. But right now, what we're saying here is that you could justify, Mark, I see your hand, you could justify what they did as an act of saving the majority, and that's what they felt was necessary, and after all, the Philistines are going to overrun everybody anyway. That's one justification. But I want to show you another two justifications. A second justification is that Samson fundamentally is harming the Philistines, right? He is. I mean, he's destroying their property, he's killing them, and so on. And you could argue that he is labeled effectively a criminal. It sounds like a strange thing to say, but take a look at source number 4 from the same passage in the Jerusalem Talmud dealing with this. Ula Bar Koshev was demanded by the government. Jewish fellow, government wants him. He fled to Lod, to Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. The government, the Romans, surrounded the area and said, if you don't give him to us, we will destroy the area. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi appeased him. He appeased Ula Bar Koshev. He said, look, please don't hate me for doing this. And turned him over to them. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi handed him over to save everybody. Elijah, who was remembered for the good, was accustomed to appearing to him, to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Elijah the prophet used to appear to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi from time to time. But now he did not. He stopped showing up. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi fasted multiple fasts, and then Elijah appeared to him. Elijah said to him, shall I appear to traitors? You're a traitor. How could you turn him over? To which Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi replied, did I not follow the Mishnah, the lesson? Meaning, isn't that what you're supposed to do? The enemy says, turn somebody over. And I'm turning him over. To which Elijah responded, is this the lesson of the pious? Is this the lesson of those who are righteous? Meaning, you may be justified in doing so. It could be that you can find sources to support your actions. Nonetheless, it's inappropriate. You're not supposed to do it. That's not for pious people, and you're not going to merit special revelation if you engage in that kind of behavior. So Elijah is not happy, but what's the law in that case, in source number 4? Was Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi right or wrong?
Rabbi, are we speaking of the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law going beyond the letter of the law?
So I wouldn't put it as letter versus spirit, because spirit informs letter, and here it's actually two opposing things. I wouldn't call it letter and spirit so much. It's law and beyond the law. You know? Rose, you were going to say?
So this Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was actually following the Mishnah. So he actually believed himself, whether it was in error or not, that he was doing the correct thing. And he seemed himself confused.
He believes that what he's doing is correct.
He said, I'm following the Mishnah. That's what they teach me.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that he himself, it wasn't that he just did it randomly. He was following the Mishnah.
Correct.
And now he's questioning why Eliyahu is not coming to him. So he wasn't doing it because he was just doing it to make it easy for himself. He thought he was following the correct law.
Right. No, that's 100% true. But
so that puts another spin on what he did.
Yeah, no, but I think that's correct. He believes the law says turn him over because the government said turn him over. The government said this is a criminal. Now, someone wrote in the chat, and the girls wrote in the chat, but the Philistines are not a government. The Philistines are the enemy, right? And you can definitely argue that it's different. However, the Jews living in Israel under the Romans did not view the Romans as a government. They viewed the Romans as an enemy as well. So
was he liable for death? Because I think that's unclear here. Isn't that a criteria?
Yes. Yeah, so the case there seems to be a case in which he was liable for death. That seems to be the discussion. So,
So why was Elijah supposed to appear? What is the justification for Elijah appearing? Was he supposed to come and somehow rescue this guy?
Sorry, no, I should have made that more clear. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was a sage of such a level and such a level of piety that he merited special revelation from time to time from Elijah. Like Elijah would just appear to him, teach him Torah, have remarkable conversations. That's what would happen. And now he stops doing that, and that's taken as a sign that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is not worthy. That's what's going on. It's a statement that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi has done something wrong.
So had he appeared to him, it would have confirmed to the rabbi that he did the correct thing.
Correct.
Had Elijah come to him.
Yeah.
So he was looking for another level of justification.
He was looking, I mean, he took correctly, he took the non-appearance as a statement that he had been wrong.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So what you're seeing here, though, is a potential second justification, which is to say, yes, Samson is one of ours. However, what he's doing is a crime in the eyes of the Philistines, and therefore you turn him over. That would be a second argument. I think it's a difficult argument to make, but I've seen the argument made to base it on this. The third argument, and I was wondering that nobody had said this yet, I kind of thought somebody would, is Rabbi Ovadia Yosef in source number 5. He says, it is also possible they thought he would be saved from them, as happened in the end. This isn't just anybody we're turning over to the Philistines. This is Samson. The Philistines are the ones who have to worry. Right? What was the line from that trailer we saw week one? If you wanted to fight, you should have brought more men. The reality is that he does just fine. So the argument potentially here is we didn't turn him over at all. So you have three different potential justifications. It's to save the majority. It's he is a criminal. Or it's let God take care of it. Samson will be just fine. The truth of the matter is that with all of these justifications, I think we do need to recognize that this is a case of betrayal. It feels like a case of betrayal. There's no way around that. It feels like you're turning over somebody who has been endangering himself for your sake. He's been fighting the Philistines all along. How could you now betray him? And it has to feel like betrayal. So here's my question to you now. We've seen Samson betrayed by his Philistine wife. We've seen Samson betrayed by the Philistines themselves, right? Like the people at the wedding party and the people who harmed his wife. We've seen Samson betrayed by his Philistine father-in-law who gave away his wife. We've seen Samson betrayed by the Jews. Who is the only one who has not betrayed Samson? Besides his mother, who we don't know anything about at this stage in the story. But who else has not betrayed Samson?
God.
God. God is the only one. Thank you. Was that Phyllis or Ethy? I couldn't tell.
Ethy.
Ethy. Thank you. So, you're right, Ethy. God is the only one who has not betrayed Samson. And we're going to see how this plays out. Maish, I'm not going to take your hand right now. I apologize.
No problem.
Sorry, Sarah, what?
And his mother.
Right, so I said his mother, but I don't actually know what she's doing at this point in the story. I don't even know if she's alive. That's why I'm not saying her. But I'm just, because it took so long because of the computer to get started, I want to make sure that I get to where we need to go with this. So that's why I'm not taking hands right now. I apologize. Samson's faith in God survives all of the betrayals he experiences. And I think it begins with his mother, because her faith is front and center in the beginning of the story. She's the one, the messenger of God shows up and says, okay, you're going to have a child, and here's what you have to do. Don't eat these things, right? And she's willing to do it, right? Contrast that with her husband. Take a look at source number 6, from Judges chapter 13, her husband Manoach. Manoach appealed to God saying, please, my master, after she has her first vision, which Manoach does not get to experience. He says, please, my master, the man of God whom you sent, let him come to us again and show us what we shall do to the youth who is to be born. He says, I want to hear this myself. He doesn't trust what his wife is saying. He wants to hear it himself. Hatzvah Ponit, Shimshon, Samson's mother, is ready to go right away. Manoach, not so much. And it is her faith that's going to carry her as she follows all of these rules, anticipating the birth of Samson. Samson all along trusts that choice. He trusts the choice that his mother made, and he trusts the choice that God made for him. The promise that he is going to be the one who is going to begin to save Israel. So first of all, he expresses that in the fact that he remains a Nazarite. And again, we had issues about, did he drink at the party, did he not drink at the party, and ultimately gets his hair cut. But the fact is that other than these incidents, he is observing what his mother told him to do. He has a very interesting faith, and I put it in source number 7, in his eyes, in his own judgment. He believes that he is chosen, and that whatever decisions he makes have that divine endorsement. When his father says to him, really, you have to go for this Philistine woman? His response is not, I want her. His response is, she's good in my eyes. This has to be right. He hands himself over to the Philistines, right? As I wrote on in source number 7, he says, I'll go quietly. I'm not gonna fight it. I'm gonna go quietly, because he anticipates that God is going to bail him out. And then after the fight with the Philistines is over, he says, yeah, we saw this, right? The end of chapter 15, he needs water. He turns to God and he says, God, please send me water. And God, of course, sends him water miraculously. And not only that, chapter 16, the beginning of chapter 16, I've already alluded to this. Remember the way chapter 16 began. Samson is in the city of Azah, the Philistine city. He's in the house of a Zonah, and we explained what that may mean. And the Philistines find out that Samson is in Azah. But as the text said it, it simply said, the Philistines found out. How did they find out? So we've already seen the idea that the Zonah turned over Samson. Right? The Zonah was the one who turned him over. However, the commentator Malbim, Rabbi Meir Leibush, says no. He says it's not that the Zonah turned over Samson. Samson turned over Samson. This was not a sting operation, but this was a trap. He goes to Azah. He hides out there. He lets them know in order to be able to thwart their assault. Which makes a lot of sense. Because remember the story. The Philistines surround the city, waiting till morning to attack, and he gets up in the middle of the night, then he marches out like he knows what's going on, and he grabs the city gate and carries it off. How in the world did that happen? When does, you know, Samson getting up in the middle of the night, how does that fit the story? The answer is because he knew. He was the one who let the word out that he was in Azah. You know, as I wrote on the sheet, here I am, come and get me, is essentially Samson's approach. And then, of course, he divulges his secret to Delilah, and he does it thinking that God will still take care of him. He trusts in God to the end. Take a look on your sheet. It's 8, please. After Samson has told them the secret, he told his wife, if you cut my hair, I will be vulnerable. More about that in a bit. But look what happens. She cuts his hair while he's sleeping. And then she wakes him up. She cried, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And he awoke from his sleep, thinking he would break loose and shake himself free as he had the other times. For he did not know the Lord had departed from him. Says Rabbi David Kimchi in source number 9. Rabbi David Kimchi, also known as Radak. Right. So look at what he says. Had he not told her his entire heart, knowing that when he would shave, his strength would leave him? Didn't he know he had just told her everything? But he forgot in his sleep that which he told her. His first suggestion is Samson forgot. He wakes up, he's, you know, groggy. He doesn't realize that he's lost a lifetime of hair. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not buying that first one. Or, he says, the meaning of, and he did not know, is that he knew that his strength had left him, but he did not know that God had left him. For he thought that even though his strength had left him, God would help him this time lest he fall into the hands of the Philistines. Samson believes that God is going to help him and is not going to let the Philistines get him. Samson's faith in God persists despite everything. You follow? Okay. For most of Samson's career, God is loyal to him until he runs out of chances. So, for example, I mentioned that fight that he had with the Philistines in chapter 15, and then he asks for water. Take a look at source number 10. What does God do miraculously? So God split open the hollow, which is at Lehi, this place, and the water gushed out of it. He drank, regained his strength, and revived. God miraculously sends him water. This is the guy, the same guy, who got involved with, first married a Philistine woman, right? In chapter 14, and then again in chapter 16, he's getting involved with two more. And God is feeding him miracles. God is giving him strength. So Rose asks in the chat, so why did Hashem leave him? It's when he betrays his covenant with the hare, right? Because Delilah asks him, yeah, you have to tell me the source of your strength. Take a look at source number 11, please. Source number 11 is that key passage where he explains this secret. Then she said to him, how can you say you love me when you don't confide in me? This makes three times that you've deceived me and haven't told me what makes you so strong. Right? He gave her all sorts of weird stories about how he could be bound up and how he could be defeated, and they weren't true. She's frustrated. Finally, after she had nagged him and pressed him constantly, he was wearied to death, and he confided everything to her. He said to her, no razor has ever touched my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God since I was in my mother's womb. If my hair were cut, my strength would leave me, and I should become as weak as an ordinary man. Pause here for a moment. How does Samson know that?
Because he's been taught that.
Really? Did the text ever say that if he cuts his hair, he'll lose his strength? Is that a thing?
He's been taught that by his mother.
Why would his mother have said that?
Because that's the thing those are the three rules that he had to observe.
But the
mother taught him. I mean, you can't drink wine, you can't cut your hair, and you shouldn't. There was a third thing.
No, that was it. I mean, eating.
Right. Those are the two big ones, right? Contact with the dead. Critical things of being a Nazarite.
But first of all, he was never bound on the death thing. But aside from that, the text never said, do this or you lose your strength. It wasn't there. Etty, that was what you were going to say. The text never said it. Where did he invent this idea from? And if his mother did, where did she invent the idea from? Jeanette?
I would also maybe suggest that there were other things that he knew he wasn't supposed to do, like what he did with women.
Yeah.
And he didn't, there were things he wasn't supposed to do, but he didn't connect it with his strength. Or we don't see anywhere that he should have connected it with his strength.
Right. So what you do have is that in chapter 13 we were told that he would that he would be the one who would go on to save Israel, and it's that same message that gave him the rules that he was supposed to follow. So you can sort of associate it, but fundamentally what this is that his disclosure of the covenant and giving her the means to cut his hair is really the ultimate betrayal in a story of betrayals. Because here, he has betrayed the miracles that God has given him. You know, it's one thing to break rules.
He's a betrayer as well.
Hang on one second, Rose. It's one thing to break rules. It's another thing to take that which God has given you miraculously and on that break the rule. You know, it's the kid who says, please, 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 would you give me the keys, right? Wants to drive the car and doesn't just break any rule, but breaks the rules of the car specifically. Like that's what he's done. It's the biggest betrayal he possibly could engage in. Rose, you were going to say?
Betrayer, then. He is actually the ultimate betrayer.
Correct.
Because he betrayed them.
That's what it seems like. That's the idea here. And if you look carefully at the language...
Look, you're saying he betrayed God?
Yeah.
Okay.
He betrayed God. Take a look at source number 11 again. Continue there. Delilah sent for the lords of the Philistines with this message. Come up once more. He has confided everything to me. This time we got him. And the lords of the Philistines came up and brought the money with them because she got paid. She lulled him to sleep on her lap. Then she called in a man and she had him cut off the 7 locks of his head. Thus she weakened him and made him helpless. His strength slipped away from him. She cried, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And he awoke from his sleep, thinking he would break loose and shake himself free as he had the other times, for he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. Notice the language. It's not he didn't know his hair was cut. He didn't know that God had walked away. That's the key. It's not about the hair. It's about God. Professor Kaufman, who I quoted in previous weeks, take a look at source number 12. He says, remember his theme. He says, we're taking magical symbols and showing that they don't have power. It's God who is the source of power. Here we see magical substance change its nature, a magical idea clothed in the form of a religious idea. The magic would have been the, hang on, I see your question, Rosalind, but the magic would have been the power of hair. But it's not really the power of hair. It's the power that God is investing in him so long as he doesn't cut his hair. And so he says, beside the magical sign of the hair, we find its Israelite translation. Immediately after, and his strength left him, it says that God had left him. It's not about the hair. It's about the covenant.
Why is it written, if it's not so about the hair, why that when he was in the Bedasuib,
We're getting there, Ruchama. You have to wait a minute. Yes, Nurit.
Actually, I wanted to comment before that all those an incident that you mentioned before about the water and saving him all the time, I saw it more as the Shimshon tempted God.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm sure I have another proof for it, because when you said that Kinezir Elohimani, when he's telling Glila, that means he knew,
yes,
that there is, that God is behind him. So why would he tempt him?
So he absolutely knows that God is behind him, and it's because he keeps thinking he has another chance. And even here, when he wakes up, after he told her, and after they cut his hair, he still thinks he has another chance. You know people like this, who always think they have another chance.
So in other words, he knows, but he's still making his choices. We talked about making choices,
yes,
as a Nazir,
yes,
to do all the regression that he did.
Yeah. Rosalind asked how we know that he knew of his covenant with God. I mean, his mother has to tell him, or else how does he know what to do? How does he know about not cutting his hair and not drinking wine and all that? His mother has to have disclosed it. It would be very odd to think that she told him, you have to do all this, but she didn't tell him it's because a messenger of God came to us and told us. That wouldn't really fit, especially because, as Nurit notes, he keeps saying this is all about God. It's the way he talks in the end of chapter 15. It's the way he talks to Delilah. It's the way he talks when he's held at the end by the Philistines. It's all about God. But I want to continue now. I see your hands. I want to make sure that we get to this well, because this is hard enough to do when I'm not operating from a dual phone and computer. And there's so much here that's so important to see. Because Samson persists in believing that God is going to be there with him, even after he has burned his last chance. And the end of Samson's life demonstrates Samson as a role model for faith. Not faith for the Jews of his time, who wouldn't have known about this story, but faith for the reader. Watch what happens with Samson. He will be confident that God will restore his strength. He's going to accept divine justice. It's going to be unreal. We have to look at the end of his life. Take a look at source number 13, please. This is the story. The Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes. Right? There's a lot to be said about the eyes. We're going to come back to those. They brought him down to Azah, and shackled him in bronze fetters, and he became a mill slave in the prison. After his hair was cut off, it began to grow back. That's interesting. Ruchama picks up on that, and she says, if you jump to source number 14, she says what Malbim says. The Hebrew for how it grew back was tzimeach. Not tzamach, but tzimeach, which sounds like it's stronger. It's not just growing, it's growing. So take a look at Malbim, Rabbi Weiser. It said this with, it's Rabbi Meir Leibush Weiser. It said this with a strong verb because it grew unusually quickly. Otherwise, we'd be troubled. How were the Philistines not careful to shave him from time to time, knowing his strength depended on his hair?
Right.
So Malbim thinks that the strength is about the hair, but it's not about the hair. With due respect for the approach of Malbim, the strength is not about his hair. And I'm going to be able to prove it to you within the story. First of all, take a look at source 15. Don Isaac Abarbanel. It will be inappropriate to think that Samson's strength was in the hair of his head naturally and that therefore it left when the hair left and his strength returned when it started to grow again. His strength was miraculous when he kept his nizirut. I'm going to prove it to you from the story. But it's not his hair grows, therefore he's strong. It's his hair grows, he doesn't cut it, and therefore God will give him strength. It's a new opportunity here for Samson to be a Nazirite. And the proof of it is coming. You'll see how I know that this is true. Read on in the story. Go back to source number 13. We're at verse 23. Now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to their god Dagon and to make merry. They chanted, "Our God has delivered into our hands our enemy Samson." When the people saw him, they sang praises to their God, chanting, "Our God has delivered into our hands the enemy who devastated our land and who slew so many of us." As their spirits rose, they said, "Call Samson here. Let him dance for us." Samson was fetched from the prison, and he danced for them. And then they put him between the pillars. They order Samson to do something ridiculous. Professor Yehuda Elitzur, in the Dat Mikra edition of Judges of Shoftim, makes a point which I brought you in source number 16. He says, Samson dancing for them is actually part of his plan. This isn't random that he goes along with it. Samson is not the sort of person who goes along with being ridiculed normally. He's the sort of guy who would like rather die than that. But this is part of his plan. He knows what he's going to do. And so now continue in source number 13. Samson said to the boy who was leading him by the hand, "Let go of me and let me feel the pillars that the temple rests upon that I may lean on them." Uh-oh. Tell me something. How does Samson, who has no eyes, know that there are pillars there and that they are weight-bearing pillars? How does he know that? The answer is, because he's been there. He's been there before.
No, but all big structures have pillars.
Yeah, but how does he know that that's where he's standing? How does he orient himself in the room? How is he aware of that? The answer is because he's been in Aza before. He was in Aza in the beginning of the chapter, and he hung out with the Philistines. He knows exactly where he is. This is a plan. Keep on reading. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. There were some 3,000 men and women on the roof watching Samson dance. There's actually some debate as to how to read the numbers in the text. Is that there are 3,000 in the building? There are 3,000 just on the roof? Unclear. But now take a look at what happens. Then Samson called to the Lord. "O Lord God, please remember me and give me strength just this once, O God, to take revenge of the Philistines, if only for one of my two eyes." He embraced the two middle pillars that the temple rested upon, one with his right arm and one with his left, and leaned against them. Samson cried, "Let me die with the Philistines," and he pulled with all his might. The temple came crashing down on the lords and on all the people in it. Those who were slain by him as he died outnumbered those who had been slain by him when he lived. His greatest attack is in his death. So somebody asked last week, isn't this a suicide bombing?
Yeah, that's what I said.
How do you know this is not a suicide bombing? It's not. For a few reasons. Well, at least two reasons. What makes a suicide bombing so horrific? Why is it that we view a suicide attack as worse than a regular one?
Because the victims are innocent.
No, that's not about a suicide attack. That happens when people do all sorts of attacks. That's not why a suicide attack is worse.
Isn't it against the religion to commit suicide? First of all?
No,
Also,
the people committing the suicide are not soldiers and unidentifiable.
Maybe. I'm going to give you an answer. I see your hand for that.
Because the suicide is being committed in the name of their God.
But that's true for regular attacks also. What makes a suicide attack so horrific is that the person who does it is saying that they hate so powerfully that they'd be willing to die in order to get other people killed. That's the difference between a suicide attack and a regular attack. Regular attacks are also done in the name of God. Regular attacks are also done against civilians. What makes a suicide attack particularly horrific is the fact that they say they hate so much that they'd be willing to die in order to harm others. That's what's so awful. But that's not the case here. He didn't ask for this. They captured him. They put out his eyes, and they're going to kill him. And the only way that he can see to escape simply being killed is for him to attack them. He's dead anyway. It's not a suicide attack. That's number one. But number two, I think if you read the verses carefully and you think about it in the context of his story as a whole, it's because Samson doesn't think he's going to die. Samson does not expect that he is going to die in this story. And that, to me, is the major point to understand here. I want to play this through.
He doesn't die.
Hang in there. I want to play this through carefully. First of all, Malbim said before that he thought the power came back because of his hair.
Narita, Rabbi, you're muted.
You're muted.
Oh, that's annoying. That's funny. Okay, now I'm unmuted, right?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, no, I muted everybody, and that included me. Nurit, I see your hand, but I really want to go through this carefully. So let me just present this first.
Just look at the word v'enakma.
Yes.
He's doing it as a revenge.
Hang in there. First of all, v'enakma in biblical Hebrew is not always revenge. It can mean punish also. But let me play this through.
Okay, sorry.
The Malbim's suggestion that it's about his hair, that he loses it because of his hair, and that he gains it back when his hair grows. Tell me something. If that's really true, why does Samson need the prayer? Please remember me and give me strength just this once, O God. Why wasn't he already strong if it came back with the hair? It's not about the hair. It's about God granting him the strength. And Samson says, God, remember me. What is it that Samson wants God to remember about him? Does Samson want God to remember that he married Philistine women? Does Samson want God to remember that he told them to cut his hair? What is it that, when you say to God, remember me, be very careful. You don't, know what you're asking God to do. What Samson is doing here, when he says, remember me, bothered the sages of the Talmud. In source number 17, they said, Samson said before God, remember for me the 20 years I judged Israel, and I never asked anyone for any favors. They're basing it on the idea, well, there are a few different possibilities for what it's about within the text itself. But I'm going to actually skip that just in the interests of time. On a simple level, Samson is saying, remember me, because he believes that he is still, despite everything that has happened, he's still a good Jew. He's still close to God. He says, God, do it for me. And he believes that God is going to go along with it.
Why did you say Achapam?
Makshnia. Samson, I'm arguing, expects that God is going to bail him out, even as he accepts divine justice. Take a look closely at his prayer. Look at what Samson says. He says to God, give me strength just this once, achapam, as Ruchama says, just this once, God. Give me strength to punish the Philistines, if only for one of my two eyes. Tell me, a few things here. Does Samson say, God, get me out of this alive? He doesn't ask, God, get me out of this alive. Why not? Take a look at source number 18 from Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom. He, Samson, was suited for this. He deserved this due to his seduction by these lowly things. And therefore he asked to die with the Philistines since he did not deserve a greater miracle at that time. Ralbag doesn't believe that Samson thinks he's going to survive. Ralbag thinks that Samson is accepting death. But my point in bringing you Ralbag is that Ralbag suggests that Samson has accepted divine justice. He says, I deserve this. I earned my fate. And notice that he asks God for vengeance for one of his two eyes. What does that mean, for one of my two eyes? Take a look at source number 19, Rabbi Shmuel Edel, the Maharsha. He says, the answer is because he's being punished for rebelling with his eyes. He accepts that this is a punishment for him. He says, fine, one of my eyes is for that, but at least let me punish the Philistines for my other eye. For that I want revenge. The point is that Samson is accepting the divine verdict. He's good with the idea that he has earned his fate. And therefore, he doesn't ask to get out alive. And he even says, Tamot nafshi im plishtim. He says, I'm guilty. I accept it. If I die with the Philistines, so be it. But in his career, over and over again, he expected that God was going to bail him out. He married a Philistine woman. He expected that God was going to bail him out. He, surrendered himself in Aza. He surrendered himself to the tribe of Judah. He expected God was going to bail him out. He's dying of thirst. He expects that God is going to bail him out. He's in Aza with this Philistine Zonah. City is surrounded. He expects that God is going to bail him out. He tells his wife, cut my hair. He expects that God is going to bail him out. Each step of the way, Samson is confident because he was chosen. And this is what chosenness does to a person. Right? He believes he has a mission and God is going to take care of him. He's been given the tools to succeed, he believes. He's got strength. He's got his own judgment. And he accepts that wherever God takes him, he's going to go. I think Samson doesn't think he's going to die here. I think he expects that he's going to make it through yet again. Achapam doesn't mean only this time and then I'm done. Achapam means, look, God, just this once, help me out here. It's the voice of the child to the parent. Just this once, help me out. And then again, just this once, help me out. But he accepts fundamentally that he has earned whatever God does to him. You follow? I would have liked to have done this a lot more smoothly if my technology had cooperated. So it goes. But I hope the message got across. As always, I'm going to stick around for questions.
Rabbi, I have one question.
Hang on one second. I gave you review questions at the bottom of the sheet. So, hopefully that will help people with this. I want to make sure everybody knows as I put out in the email, there's a new series with Rabbi Sammy Bergman starting next week. He is wonderful. Those who were at his last series know it already. Those who have not been at a series with him, this is your opportunity. A three-part series on Rabbi Moses Maimonides, the rabbi who dared to ask and answer. And it's going to be a lot of fun, so I hope that you'll join for that the series. And then I have a new series coming up in, I guess it's going to be after Passover at this point. I have a new series coming up after Passover, and I'm thinking about doing Pirkei Avot. We'll see. Either that or the Book of Ruth. We'll see. So we'll see.
Just a second. Why did you say Tamot Nafshi in Nafshi.
So you could take that in two different ways. It's an interesting question Ruchama asks. Samson says in the Hebrew, and this won't be carried in the English, but Tamot Nafshi in Plishtim, my spirit should die with the Philistines. So you could say it's just a dramatic way to say that he should die. Tamot, even if I die. But Nafshi is, you know, is being dramatic, my spirit, my soul. Or the word nefesh often means desire. The desire as in what you want, what you wish for. And maybe he's saying that that should die with the Philistines. But I think that's extreme. I'm not sure. I think you could read it either way. Okay, so I'm going to stick around for questions and comments.